Today I want to deal with the Protestant Reformation. And the person who begins this is, of course, Martin Luther. Luther is born in 1483. He is the son of poor parents, stern father, who intended Luther to be brought up to be a lawyer. And Luther, indeed, started his schooling for law. But Luther was somewhat psychotic in some respect. He felt that he was damned. He felt for sure that he was never going to get to heaven, no matter what he tried to do. Consequently, he was very afraid much of the time. He was caught in a great storm in the woods one day, and he was so terrified that he prayed, if God saved him from this, that he would abandon the law and enter the monastery. And God did save him, and he abandoned the law and entered a monastery. Now, he became an Augustinian monk, but that did not resolve his problem. He still felt he was never going to get to heaven. He felt there was no way that he was ever going to manage this. He went through all of his clerical training. He indeed did jobs, took up teaching, and only finally did he have a revelation that indeed the only true road to salvation is through God's grace. And indeed, that God will offer you salvation if you want it enough. And it is not through doing good works, it is not through all kinds of busy things at all, it is just because God is kind, and if you want to be saved, God will indeed save you if you want it badly. So this is the beginning of his doctrine of the salvation through grace. Now, this is not a real break. That's based in part on St. Augustine's ideas. The break does not come until 1517. In 1517, there was a papal indulgence published in Germany. An indulgence is the concept that goes back to the Crusades, that if you do something for the church can draw on a kind of bottomless oversupply of good deeds and of value that have been added up by saints and martyrs, and can rescue you indeed from purgatory, take you to heaven. And this was what was offered to crusaders. Now later on, they began to use this in different ways, such as, for instance, when they needed money. So they began to sell indulgences, in fact. And they got into more questionable practices here. Because before an indulgence was usable, you had to repent your sins honestly. You had to confess and repent. Just paying money wasn't enough. But they also began to sell you indulgences, for instance, get your dead father or grandfather out of purgatory into heaven also. And since they no longer seemed to be in a very good position to repent, it became a little questionable as a practice. But they went ahead, and in 1517, the church needed money. For one thing, the Archbishop of Mainz was dead broke and in debt, because he had had to give up all the first year's income and also pay a lot of money to get that position. So he needed cash. And the Vatican needed cash because they were tearing down old St. Peter's to build a brand new church, the church that now stands. So an indulgence was published, and it was to be split between these two causes, part to go to Rome for the building of St. Peter's, part to pay off the indebtedness of the Archbishop of Mainz. Now, this seemed a troublesome practice to Martin Luther at best, but he was more infuriated because they had hired a real hotshot salesman named John Tetzel, who was selling indulgences high, wide, and handsome, and he kept forgetting to tell people they had to repent or it wouldn't do any good. Now that infuriated Martin Luther completely with his concept of the doctrine of salvation through grace. Indulgences wouldn't do any good anyway. So he wrote out 95 reasons why this was a wrong practice and nailed it to the church door at Wittenberg. Now, that actually is what starts the Protestant Reformation. For one thing, of course, those 95 theses were copied and printed in vast numbers off printing presses immediately. So they became widely known. And this then offended the church, since it was a standard church usage, and indeed the Dominican order rose now to defend this principle, and they arranged for an argument or a public debate between Martin Luther and the Dominican named Master Eck. Now, Master Eck is a very good debater, and he's a very clever man, because he started pinning Martin Luther down on things, and he said, "Would you not accept this on papal authority?" And Martin Luther said, "No, I wouldn't." And he said, "All right, what kind of authority do you consider higher than that of the papacy?" And Martin Luther said, "A general council of the church has greater authority than does the Pope." And Master Eck then said, "All right, let's look at the Council of Constance. Would you agree with the Council of Constance in having John Huss burned at the stake?" And Martin Luther said, "No, I wouldn't." And Eck said, "You consider yourself to be a higher authority than the church council." And Martin Luther said, "I consider my own conscience to be a better guide to what is right than the Pope or a church council." Now that's heresy. That is all out flat heresy with no discussion about it at all. That's heretical. You can't do that. So this now got Martin Luther branded as heretical, and he was finally summoned to appear before the imperial court, that is the Diet at Worms, before the emperor. By this time, he had also been sent a papal bull, which he had burned publicly. Now, that sounds marvelous, but in fact, people have been burning papal bulls for 1,000 years publicly. It is not unique, nor was wanting to debate points unique. The one great unique point is when he is given, again, a free pass to attend the emperor's court at Worms, and he appears before it and is questioned by the emperor. And here he stands his ground. He will retract nothing whatsoever. And as a result, he is not only branded a heretic, but is made an outlaw. Now, an outlaw means just this. You are outside the law, and any person at all can kill you out of hand without incurring a charge of murder. In other words, it's a kind of death warrant, usually. However, Martin Luther left the council at Worms and then disappeared totally. What had happened was that a friend of his, the elector of the state of Saxony, had spirited him off to a castle for safekeeping so that he would not be in danger of being killed off. Now, it is while Martin Luther is in the castle at the Wartburg that he works out his theology. One of the first things that he does is to translate the Bible into German. And in fact, it is that German translation of the Bible which establishes North German as being the literary form of German language. Secondly, one of the things that he does not translate are those mysterious four books that occur between the Old and the New Testament called the Apocrypha. These are books such as Judith and Tobit and 1st and 2nd Maccabees. They had always been questioned somewhat. Were they revealed truth, or were they, in fact, later histories, was the question. Martin Luther decides against them, and by deciding against them, he drops purgatory out of the picture, because the main biblical reference to purgatory is in Maccabees 2. Now, dropping purgatory out of the picture makes an enormous change from what had been Christian before this time. Remember that up to this time, if you committed a mortal sin, you went to hell. But if you had committed venial sins, you went to purgatory and you suffered a lot, but you worked them off and eventually you would reach paradise. In other words, there was a place for small sinners. And it is not a black and white world, but there's a nice area of grays in there. Not any longer. With Martin Luther now, you are either saved or you're damned, and there is nothing in between at all. It becomes a black-white, yes-no world. And this is psychologically one of the very sharp changes that takes place here. Okay, that's a major change. Now, at the same time, he also cuts down the number of sacraments from the 7 required by Catholicism down to 2 or 2.5. He cuts it down to baptism and communion because the references to these are found in the Bible. The query Pap is that he thinks confession may be good for you, so it's all right and may be helpful, hence the famous 2.5 here. Now, when he cuts out purgatory, needless to say, indulgences are now no use at all. What's more, there is no point in having saints anymore. Saints for intercessors who help to get you out of purgatory into heaven or dead thing. Now, there's no point in saints. Saints are abolished. Equally, there's nothing so good about Mary anymore either. She, after all, had been the main intercessor because surely her own son would listen to Mama. But now, if there's nothing to intercede for, forget her too. So that goes by the board along with it. There are an enormous number of sharp changes that take place. And he does insist, among other things, that the clergy should be allowed to marry, that you should not have monasteries and nunneries, and they should all get out and get married. Now, indeed, this particular tract is read by a nun named Katrin van Bora. And she thinks that's the greatest thing she's ever read in her life. She abandons her nunnery and goes straight to the Wartburg to see Martin Luther to tell him, "You really hit it on the nail, sir, that time. That's a fine idea." And he says, "You bet, and you're nice looking. You're a very nice girl." So they get married. Actually, Catholics, of course, almost doubled up dying of laughter in this. A renegade monk married to a renegade nun surely would not be listened to. The Catholics could not have been more wrong on all of this. A lot of people were listening to Martin Luther, indeed. Among them, a lot of peasants. And the peasants, indeed, felt that his theory on freedom of conscience, all of this sort of thing, would sympathize with them in trying to get rid of a whole lot of outworn feudal taxes, labor taxes, dues of this kind. And the peasants rose, particularly along the Rhine, and went to war against their overlords. Now, they appealed to Martin Luther for his support. And Martin Luther's first response to them was that they should not go to war against their overlords, that after all, the things that happen on this earth are of no importance to salvation at all. And they should render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and just stop this nonsense. Now, the peasants did not go along with it. And it infuriated Martin Luther, and he wrote a diatribe against the thieving, murdering peasants, is the name of it, in which, among other things, he says that no one ever has a right to rebel against the government which they are a part, and that the peasants should be slaughtered out of hand. They should be strangled, stabbed, drowned, killed in any way possible as being utterly worthless and no good. It is Luther at his least attractive at this point. But it is notable that what Luther is doing is aligning himself to the princes. And Lutheranism is immediately lined up with the heads of government, in Germany's in particular. It is notable that Luther believes that it should be a state church and the government should be essentially the head of this church. He thinks that marriage, for instance, is a civil matter, not a religious matter. And since he believes that there should be no monasteries or nunneries, if the ruler of a territory adopted Lutheran ideas, he could not only stop all taxes to Rome, he could also seize all monastic lands, which was indeed a rich haul for any prince. Now, this tended to make Lutheranism deeply attractive to princes. The result was that Lutheranism tends to spread in North Germany. Saxony takes it up once, it spreads up into Prussia, across northern Germany. Eventually, it will be taken up by the Scandinavian states. Sweden will adopt it, Denmark. It will extend over in part into Poland and into the Netherlands. Indeed, Lutheran tracts will begin to invade England. So Lutheranism is expensive very quickly indeed. It establishes itself, and it establishes itself as a form of Christianity which is allied to government and gives government more rights than it ever had under the old church. Now, this created, of course, enormous problems. There were many attempts made to try to get Christianity back together again. But indeed, there was no success in this at all. And eventually, in fact, the Emperor Charles V is bound up in two wars against some of the Lutheran princes. Eventually, he's not going to be successful. Fairly successful in the first, not so successful in the second. And in 1555, they will sign the Peace of Augsburg. Now, that's an important date and an important peace treaty, because what it does is to give official recognition to Lutheranism. And it states that within the Holy Roman Empire, the ruler can name the religion. The system is called cuius regio, eius religio. Whoever owns the government gets to name the religion, in other words. The problem with this is that it recognizes only Catholicism or Lutheranism. No other varieties of Protestantism are recognized by the Peace of Augsburg. And some other varieties are already appearing en scène. Notably, down in Switzerland, at Zurich, there's a reformer named Zwingli, Zwingli. Zwingli, indeed, takes up a rather extreme Protestant position against the church. He manages to get the city-state of Zurich along with him. He is, in some respects, more radical than Luther. Luther's position on communion is roughly that of consubstantiation. Zwingli says it is just a memorial feast which remembers Christ's sacrifice, but that Christ is not necessarily present at communion. And indeed, Zwingli and Luther then proceeded to write diatribes against each other. It is notable with Luther, I think you must state this, that while Luther believed in everyone having freedom of conscience, everybody's freedom of conscience had better be the same as his. He is indeed somewhat authoritarian on these factors and takes a dim view of anyone who wants to argue a theological point. It is notable that all of the reformers will say that revelation stopped with early Christianity. The one source of revealed truth is the Bible. And the second source of revealed truth is always, inevitably, the Bible as interpreted by them. Rather firmly here. Now, Zwingli, after diatribes against Luther and back and forth, was killed in a battle. But it meant that Switzerland had been involved now in a series of religious turbulences, disturbances of various kinds. And at the same time in Germany, among peasants particularly, grew up something called Anabaptism. Anabaptism goes back to early Christianity. It does not develop anything like the kind of theology that Lutheranism does. The name comes from the fact that they believed people had to be baptized again. A In other words, that if you were baptized as an infant, you had to wait until you were old enough to be able to make a choice yourself. Then you are baptized again. Then you become, if I may say so, a born-again Baptist. At this point. But this particular form, which in some areas believed also in community property, that is, property owned communally, was most popular with peasants. There are no major lords who go along with this concept, and eventually Anabaptism fell in very bad repute, particularly after the affair of Münster. Münster is a German city which was seized by Anabaptists under the lead of a man named John of Leiden. They threw everyone else out. It underwent a long siege. John of Leiden plunked for being able to have several wives, among other things, polygamy. And then he got very angry with one of his wives and took her down to the marketplace and beheaded her publicly and trampled her body underfoot, which was considered rather a no-no. There were a number of other leaders there. Nipperdalek is one of them, or Nipperdalek. Sounds as though I'm being a very bad Hungarian version of something, but Nipperdalek is such a lovely name. He is a rich man who went along with Anabaptism and was in Münster. Now, eventually, the siege failed at Münster. But all of this communal property, polygamy, murdering of a wife, and so on, gave Anabaptism a very bad name for a very long time. The three leaders of this were, in fact, then imprisoned in iron cages, and those iron cages were hung from a church tower. Until they died today. And in fact, those three iron cages, though now empty, still hang from the church tower in Münster. They were knocked down in World War II and put right back up as soon as they restored it. Münster is not about to give up its iron cages. However, the most important of the varieties of Protestantism, aside from Lutheranism, is, of course, Calvinism. John Calvin was French. He's born later than Luther, and he was trained to be a lawyer, and he completed his law studies. Then, indeed, he entered the clergy, he taught at the Sorbonne, and there he was involved with a reform element. Now, the kings of France were not interested in reform in France of the church. They had a concordat with the papacy signed in 1517, which said that the kings of France could name the persons to receive all of the top church offices in France. That gave the kings of France considerable control, and they weren't about to lose that control of the church. Hence, they're opposed to Lutheranism, and the reform elements in Paris now had to flee the country. John Calvin fled from Paris. He intended to go to the free city of Strasbourg, but he went via Geneva. And when he arrived in Geneva, he was welcomed wholeheartedly by a red-headed Frenchman who had preceded him, a man named William Farel. Now, Farel was notorious in Switzerland for creating disturbance. Farel's pet trick was to wait outside a church until they were celebrating solemn high mass, and he would wait to this point in which the wafer is elevated, the presence of God comes in. Farel would then come charging down the main aisle of the church, grab this away from the priest and say, "You call that your God? Wow!" Riots all over the place. It was indeed spectacular. So, Farel indeed is this kind of rebel, and he insisted that Calvin had been sent to Geneva by God and should settle in Geneva and help him to reform that city. So they settled down to do what they could in Geneva. there continued to be disturbances, and finally they were both asked to leave the city. Calvin then went to Strasbourg. In Strasbourg he wrote out the first edition of his famous theology called the Institutes, dedicated incidentally to the King of France, and later revised to be about three times as long. He also got married there. And then he was called back to Geneva. Now, from this time on, Geneva will be Calvin's home, and it is the home city of Calvin. Geneva was an independent city within the empire. And Calvin established there a kind of theocracy. The city itself was run by a council made up of preachers and of church elders. And these are the ruling body of the town. Now, Calvin, in terms of his ideas, is far more rigorously logical than was Luther. Luther rarely carries any of his ideas to an extreme position. Calvin always does. He is a lawyer trained, and his theology reads like it. Now, it has been said that Luther's God is the God of the New Testament, a loving and a kindly God. But Calvin's God is the God of the Old Testament, who is an angry and unforgiving God by comparison. So, indeed, Calvinism is based largely on the Old Testament, on St. Paul, and on some parts of St. Augustine's writings. It is notable, for instance, that he sets up as a prime idea the concept of predestination, or the elect. And indeed, it runs this way. God exists outside of time and space. With God, neither of these things exist at all. Therefore, in that moment in which God created this universe, God already knew what the entire history of the universe and everyone within it would be, since time does not exist within it. Consequently, he must have known and deliberately in that moment of creation already have determined who in the whole history of the universe would be saved and who would be damned. You are predestined to damnation or to salvation, and you have no choice. You can do all the good deeds you want if you are predestined to be damned, and it will not help you. There is no such thing as free will in Calvin or in Luther, as far as that goes. But it is notable with predestination that Calvin assumes several things. If you are predestined to salvation, you will indeed demonstrate this in your life by leading a godly life. You don't have to do good deeds, but you will do good deeds because you are predestined to salvation. Equally, you will be responsible for all persons around you. Hence, you must pass the proper laws, all the rest of these factors. And it is notable that he also assumes if you are predestined to salvation, you will prosper on this earth. Now, that had quite a lot of appeal to the rising middle class, particularly merchants and so on. It introduces the concept that there is something holy and sacred and favorable to God out of making money. Now, that has appealed to a great many people ever since, and rather passionately to a lot of Americans. It is notable that you have Anabaptism appealing to peasants, that you have, in fact, Lutheranism appealing to princes, and Calvinism to townspeople and middle-class people. These are the social distinctions that go on. All right, so Calvin establishes also, basically, that communion is a memorial feast, and Calvin begins to work up a new Calvinist city from which his ideas may flow out. He establishes, indeed, a university of Calvinism, a theological school in Geneva, where all kinds of people flock and are trained to carry Calvinism abroad. They establish a whole new set of laws in Geneva by this government. It is notable, for instance, that this is, I suppose, the real introduction of what we would call blue law today. It is true that in the past there had been something called sumptuary law, that is, that themselves up to be doing booby traps for men. This is wrong. What's more, there shall be no singing in Geneva except for hymns. There will be no dancing, none of this frivolity. There will be no playing of cards or games. Everyone will go to church on Sunday and twice on Sunday, and you will do no work on Sunday, and you will do no play on Sunday either. Not only do you not play golf, you don't go walking along the river bank with friends either. There are, after all, lots of bushes along river banks. And on Sunday, no, no. It is indeed a stern life. It is lived as such. It is notable that no one in Geneva is allowed to give a child any name that does not occur in the Bible. So that you had the unfortunate instance of a father and mother who tried to name their newly born son Claudius. Now, that's a Roman name, but it does not occur in the Bible. The response was quite simple. They were thrown in prison until they decided Abraham would do just as well. It is a kind of formidable approach to these things. Let me give you another example. There's great stress placed on the Ten Commandments, for instance, and it is notable that one of those commandments is respect for your father and mother, right? So in Geneva there occurred the case of a boy about 10 years old who got into a terrible tantrum one day when he attacked his mother and father, "I hate you," and all the rest of this, bearing on like crazy. The response there was quite simple. Obviously, he's damned. He was taken to prison, condemned, and beheaded. Aha, how many of you would have survived out of the Well, I think sometimes wonder. In other words, life is somewhat formidable, let us say, in Geneva in this period. And it is true that a number of people moved out of Geneva permanently. On the other hand, more people moved in. Now, this is enormously popular. And it is also notable that Geneva is famous by the mid-century as being the cleanest city in all of Europe. It is indeed a Calvinist concept that cleanliness is next to godliness. Most of those famous old saws we have brought up with are, in fact, Calvinist in inspiration. Now, much that Calvinism developed is not due to John Calvin. John Calvin himself preached an extremely lofty view of God. Calvin, indeed, preached the concept that God is beyond human understanding, that God's majesty lies beyond anything that humans can hope to conceive, and it must be accepted in this form. And indeed, Calvin himself always tried to suggest to people that they not be too sure that they were predestined to salvation, or too sure that other persons were not. In other words, they should attempt not to become bigoted on this subject. On the other hand, in actual practice, Calvinism, of course, lends itself to bigotry very easily and quickly, because indeed you have to feel that you are yourself predestined to salvation. No one else from outside can tell you. And this leads to a certain amount of self-satisfaction beyond any question. Also, you are your brother's keeper. And it is notable that a great many people through the years since have enjoyed that. They may have done away with the worship of saints, but they tend to sanctify the snooper. Indeed, in Geneva, you had small children trained to go around and report to the church authorities. The lady next door owns playing cards, and her hair is not that color. And on with this, and you get then this concept of the holier-than-thou personality, who's going to tell you what's wrong with you for your own good, and who is going to relish every minute of that, and who is going to write letters to the newspaper for everybody's own good. What's wrong with you, and what's wrong with you, and what's wrong with the university, and all the rest of it. This goes very much with this. At its best, it could be fine. At its worst, it is, of course, dreadful. And it goes with, of course, the concept of establishing rigid laws for what you consider your own theology to be, but which most often tends to be your own private and individual taste on this. I suppose I might just as well suggest that Anita Bryant would have loved Geneva. It is much like this kind of aspect. And indeed, it is notable that Calvinism becomes an extremely aggressive form of Christianity, far more so than Lutheranism or Anabaptism. It becomes the avant-garde. Spreading very rapidly and formidably. Spreading into the Netherlands, spreading into Poland, spreading into Hungary, spreading into Scotland with John Knox very quickly, and of course, eventually spreading with the Mayflower into the 13 colonies. And indeed, I suppose America is the eminent Calvinist state in many respects. Everything in America has been tinged by Calvinism from the 17th century on. Even Catholicism, Judaism, all of the other branches of religion in America become just faintly touched with Calvinism. It is inherent in this country to an extreme degree. The perfect example is, I suppose, cleanliness is next to godliness. You have only to realize that no country in the world has ever been as obscenely obsessed with cleanliness as America. For you not only have all the antiperspirants and all the things to do away with human smells, but even special ones for what I assume to be the unlikeliest areas of one's body, now showing up in late ads on TV in the most extraordinary way. I suppose no one in America knows what a human being smells like or has for several generations. For all you know, they might smell naturally, just like the kind of perfume you put on yourself to get back to that again. It is cleanliness to an excessive degree. Or all of this business in bakeries, you know, where you order 6 cookies and she takes a little piece of paper so human hands shall not touch this and put it in something else. It is then wrapped up, it is then put in something else which is wrapped up, and then it's packaged. It's bizarre. You go on and on with this sort of thing to prevent any kind of faint contamination. Now, this is basically Calvinism, and it comes through in an infinite number of ways here. It has simply so pervaded our thinking. The concept, the work ethic, which we read so much about. Work is good for you. Now, the Calvinist phrase is, the devil makes work for idle hands. So keep busy. And our function is to see that you do keep busy. It doesn't matter whether you like it or hate it. It helps save you. Look at it that way. All we think about is your salvation. It is a thoroughly and consistent force that moves along here. Now, in this sense, it has far more impulse
than does any of the other of the Lutheran form, of the Lutheran or Anabaptist or Anglican forms at all. It is one that is proselytizing, that moves out, which indeed has a kind of vigor. And the very fact that it allies itself to the rising middle class means that it is going to be allied with what is going to be the most successful class shift in coming history, that is, the rise of the middle class to importance and power. So that it has picked a winning horse here also. So that this is what Calvinism is going to, in essence, be. Now, all of this does not mean that Catholicism is going to simply wither away and cease. Because, in fact, as we will see eventually, Catholicism is going to stage a very sharp comeback. It will, indeed, in time, be able to roll back part of the territory it has lost. Nonetheless, the 16th century, because of the Protestant Reformation, is going to be a period of enormous religious tension in which these various forms of religion will battle against each other. And they will, indeed, battle vigorously and viciously. You must remember that in 16th century Europe, toleration is not a virtue. Tolerance is not believed to be a virtue. Tolerance is believed simply to be wishy-washy weakness. That you have to have convictions. And in the 16th century, the path of virtue is, indeed, to follow your convictions out, to go to war against those who don't believe the same as you do, and indeed to enjoy killing them in rather large numbers. Now, this is not something that just the Catholics do. This is something that the Lutherans, the Calvinists, the Anabaptists, and almost everybody gets a whack in on this. To make a Calvinist or a Lutheran really happy, give them a few Jesuits they can string up or burn at the stake. You've made their whole day for them. This is an intolerant age, and you can only understand it if you understand that intolerance lies at the heart and core of the entire age itself. This is not going to be an age in which these swords are going to be beat into plowshares. Eventually, we're going to have to look at that long, horrid period known as religious wars, which are full of massacres that made a lot of people happy. But of course, massacres never make everyone happy. They're always the people who were massacred, they hate it.